Welcome back to Spoiled Fruit, Faith and Power. In part two of our extended interview with former Vineyard pastor J.T. Meyer, we pick up where we left off. As J.T. begins to challenge the Vineyard's silence around LGBTQ inclusion and attempts to remain in fellowship while holding space for a broader theological conversation. But instead of dialogue, he's met with silence, isolation, and eventually exile. This is a powerful account of what happens when institutional loyalty is valued more than pastoral presence, and when speaking up means stepping away. Again, this is the unedited version. Listener discretion is advised. Yeah, and I think, you know, and I'm sure that they're looking at what are other denominations, what other movements doing, what have they done in the past, what seems to be effective. And like, and again, I don't, you know, I think we've mentioned, you know, earlier that there's probably not a perfect system. But, you know, I think that was one of the questions I asked Pastor Doug. I said, you know, what level of autonomy, you know, do Lutheran churches have versus, you know, because maybe there's something there where like they really don't have any control. And it seems like, you know, they've tried to address that issue by, you know, the local church council or board, the names kind of differ or whatever, do not include the pastor. Pastor does not get a vote. So there's some local checks and balances in place in coordination with like, you know, a bishop or a regional leader. You try to make sure that the congregation still has a voice in it. And there's a transparency policy where they go to the congregation immediately. They're informed of what's going on. And so, yeah, it's a very tricky and complicated balance to hold. How do you ensure that the local people have a voice in what happens, but also have some sort of centralized level of accountability as well?
Well, and I mean, I think this segues into kind of what happened with my church in that. So like, this was like right after what happened with Anaheim. And the main takeaway that I think a lot of people got from Anaheim was, wow, this person just made this unilateral decision to remove this church from the movement. And there wasn't even a conversation. There wasn't even like, you know, so over the last number of years, I had been really wrestling with what I believed about LGBTQ issues. And I had really landed at this place at the time where I was like, gosh, I don't know what I believe about it, but I don't know if I'm willing to pastor a church that draws a really hard line in the sand. Like, can't we just agree to disagree about this? And so I went to my region or my super regional leader and just said, hey, listen, this is something that I'm wrestling with. And this is something that our church is like kind of, you know, working through. And I don't think I believe what the Vineyard believes anymore, but I want to come to you and walk through this with you as the Vineyard. I believe in the Vineyard and I love the Vineyard. Can we do this relationally? And I'll just say it wasn't a conversation. It wasn't very relational, but it was one of those things where it would have been a thing where the if this happened post this, you know, the new things that they're laying out, they could have just said, you're not the pastor of this church anymore. It's our church and we're putting a new pastor in place. And to me, part of it, that's where part of it, I have this real check to say like, no, listen, like, I feel like the Lord has called me to pastor this church and I really want accountability, but I don't know if I want Vineyard USA to be the one who decides the fate of my church. And there's a lot that goes into that, but part of it, well, I'll say this first. Walking through that was probably the hardest thing that I had done in ministry ever. It felt so lonely and so isolating, and seeing and hearing things that people within the Vineyard were saying about me personally and saying to me were just like, you know, I had Vineyard pastors that told me that I was sending people to hell, that I was a heretic, that I, you know, all kinds of things, and that I was a false teacher, that we're not worshiping Jesus, we're worshiping Satan. And I will say there were a couple Vineyard pastors. I want to shout out Evan Bruscoat because he was the best. But there were a couple of Vineyard pastors who really wanted to like see how I was doing and just wanted to talk to me about like, gosh, this has got to be a hard thing for you. Can I be praying for you? But for the most part, especially within the actual leadership structure, there was none of that. It was the only communication I had was making sure that I wasn't doing the things that crossed the line and trying to debate with me about why my theology was wrong. For the most part, I had a couple okay conversations, and one of them was with Jay, actually. But for the most part, all the communication I had was just, you're not doing this, are you? And you know, can I change your mind? And wasn't there, like, and even from Jay, there was just none of like that kind of shepherding, like, how is your soul in this? So that was really hard. And then kind of circling back, my main issue was not that I didn't want accountability from people, and I'll leave these people nameless, but I just started seeing people being chosen to be people of power and holding people accountable that I was like, I know for certain that you're a person I don't trust. Like, you're a person that I know has done a lot of stuff that I think is not cool. And so, like, and then when you would see these, like, I think you would see things happen within the vineyard that I saw firsthand of local pastors doing things that at the least were really poor decision and at worst were like evil. The response from the different levels of leadership wasn't accountability. It was circling the wagons to protect the vineyard name. And there oftentimes, most of the time, it didn't feel like the victims were being cared for, or the victims were being, you know, even bare minimum care. Like, how are you doing? It was, how do we protect the vineyard name and how do we protect our vineyard pastors? And some of that, I think I will give them the benefit of the doubt that wasn't done intentionally. But to me, I just feel like, I don't know if I want to trust systems of leadership that actually aren't there to protect me. They're interested in protecting the vineyard.
Yeah. And there were some clear incidents that really popped out to me that really hit on what you're saying right now. And the same thing, it's like, okay, I want to give this person the benefit of the doubt that maybe their first instinct may have not been the right one. But then there's evidence to show that in some of those situations, like, they sort of doubled down on it later and kind of stuck to their guns. And you're like, all right, at this point, this flies in the face of common sense. You know, one of the things that really stuck out to me was, you know, some of the conversations between particularly like Rob Morgan and, you know, the special committee at Duluth, who are trying their best to kind of feel, you know, walk through this field of landmines at this point and trying to do what's best for the victims and also trying to shepherd their church through this mess. And Rob just keeps telling him, like, you know, you should keep Michael, you know, at least as overseer of the church to guide them through this process. I'm like, this whole mess is because of your son. Like, you can't touch this with a 10-foot pole because of clear conflict of interest. And then you see him sort of double down on this, you know, in later emails, and you're like, okay, this seems like a pretty clear cut and dry case of conflict of interest. Like, this is just bad guidance. And then you see, you know, criticisms of how they're kind of speaking and interacting with the Gatlins. And it's like, no, they're doing the right thing. Like, they have got to, you know, effectively run this investigation internally and figure out exactly what it is that happened and who knew what and when. And like, this is not going to be pretty and this is not going to be fun for anyone, but it's necessary. And like, now is not the time for coddling. Now is the time for action. You know, this has been buried for a decade. Plus,
and that's where I think it got really complicated. And I don't know, I'll just say kind of off the record, like, this, like, can I want to be really careful about how I talk about
yes
this part. So I have had a long history with Rob and Julie Morgan and lots of positive friendship. I've experienced nothing negative from them. And so I don't know intentions behind why some of these decisions were made. But when I look at how the Duluth situation was handled, or I look at some of the other situations that I'm very close to, how they were handled, I look and think, is that the kind of leadership that I want to say can decide if I am fit to be the pastor of my church or not? And it's not the kind of leadership that I do. And so for me, what's really complicated is, like, Jay was like my camp counselor when I was in middle school. And like, you know, I've had, you know, tons of time hanging out with these people. And I've grown to, like, especially as a young pastor, I would, like, really looked up to them. And many of them really invested in me and spoke life into me. And so what's really hard is when you start seeing some of the stuff that's happening now, and you're confronted with, like, whoa, this doesn't feel this doesn't feel like the person that I know. And that's why a lot of these things of the relational nature of the vineyard and then having all this power structure doesn't work very well. Because like my inclination right now is to defend these people that I know, but I don't know what they did. And I don't know, like, because, you know, like, I'm blinded by my relationship with them. You know, do you know what I mean? Like, the vineyard wants it oftentimes, and it's not just the vineyard, but they want the best of, they want it both ways. They want to keep up this relational thing where we're buddies and we're friends, and the way that you get position is by relationship. But then they also want to create power structures, and that just does not work. It's unhealthy, and it causes stuff like this to happen.
I wonder also, you just made me think of something, and one of the things in, and I hate to keep relating this to corporate life, but I think there's some parallels there, and I think there's some things that the corporate world does very, very well. And one of the things, a study came out years ago, and I've lived this myself in all the years of management I've been in. For those who don't know, up until recently, I have managed for decades, managed various sizes of teams and so on. And one of the studies that came out that I wholeheartedly agree with some years ago is this idea that there's this sort of misnomer or misperception, I guess, within all industries that, you know, you always got to promote your top performer. And there's a lot of other sort of discernment that needs to take place before you do that. Now, sometimes that works. Sometimes your top performer ends up being this great, you know, and I'm speaking specifically of taking somebody who's like more of an individual contributor and putting them into a role of leadership or management. And sometimes that happens. And sometimes, you know, you see that, you know, that really take root and you're like, that person just continues to move up the chain and promote up and has a flourishing career and it's great. But not always. And sometimes the things that make that person great as an individual contributor, they don't necessarily always have the skills that it takes because it's a very different skill set. And so sometimes you're putting that person in a position to fail, you know, because they don't have the skill set. And there's also, no matter how many, you know, sort of leadership characteristics you inherently have, there's still amount of training that's involved. You know, I think of symbolic leadership workshops that I had to go through years ago that at the time I thought, this is so dumb. I do not want to role play in front of my peers talking about like how I'd have a conversation with a stinky person at work. Like, I don't want to do that. But then, you know, you run into real world examples where you're like, oh, man, I have to have that very conversation. And thank God that I was given like sort of the skill set to walk through that, you know. And so I think about that in relation to some of these folks who, as you said, like maybe really good people and awesome friends and have great hearts, but perhaps were elevated for all the wrong reasons and are in positions that they have no business being in. I'm not saying specifically anybody in particular. I'm just saying in general, you know, sometimes leadership isn't for everyone, and that's not a position where that person might flourish in necessarily.
Absolutely. And I think the problem, like, because I know of people who were put into leadership positions within the vineyard who had active, you know, investigations going on against them. And that's recent. Not like that's not under the old guard. Those are people who, like, there's investigations about improprieties and moral issues, yet they, in the middle of it, they're given platform on national levels. And to me, that's just like, well, even if that's the right person for the job, like, let's just wait to see how some of this stuff plays out. And so I think the issue, you're right. Like, I think in especially Western Christianity, we have confused charisma and gifting with character. And there's people that I know who are extremely gifted and extremely charismatic, but have no business being in a leadership position because they lack character, or they don't know what they're doing. They haven't gone through the training, or they're really good at like performing a certain thing. Like, they're a great speaker or they're a great, you know, worship leader, but they can't help other people do that, or they can't manage other people. And I know, like, and it's not just on the national level. I know people who've been given position on local levels, like, you know, and within local churches who it's like, oh, this person is a great worship leader. I should have them oversee my worship department. but they're not a good person, or they're like, you know, or they're not a leader. They're just a great singer. Or they're like, you know, people are like, oh, this person should be an area leader because they have done a really good job of growing their church, but they're not very pastoral. Like they're not really good at shepherding and caring for pastors. And so like, I think I don't think it's a vineyard problem. I think it's a modern church problem of we are getting blinded by talent and how big people got their church or how like, you know, they spoke at a conference and wow, that person was a great speaker. We should give them a position as this. And it's like, or it's something like this guy has been my buddy forever and I want him to be on my, you know, I want him to have this position. And I know for a fact that there are people in positions who were technically interviewed, but like no one reached out to like former area leaders or regional leaders to see like, hey, what were some of the experiences you had working alongside this person?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I just think I'm not against these new things that the Vineyard wants to do. My problem is the ambiguity of it. And sometimes I think our picker has been off. The people we have picked to be in those positions are like, I don't know if we're doing a good job at that. And I think we need maybe a better system of doing that.
Well, it kind of goes back to the handbook that we were talking about earlier. Under the guidelines to be considered, you know, going forward to be considered for ministry, I'm pretty sure the very last one is a background check. I'm like, shouldn't that be number one up at the top? I mean, I guess as long as it's on the list somewhere, that's good. But feels like that should be the first one. That might weed out a few people right at the jump.
Totally. Yeah.
What's interesting too is, you know, again, when I was kind of doing the exercise of comparing other movements, other denominations, you know, there's a form, and this was kind of interesting to me too. And I would love for you to kind of tell me, you know, you just mentioned earlier that you went through VLI. So I'm very curious to know. So what that process is like, I just know what my dad went through, right? So like four years of intensive grad school, 3 years of classroom work, 1 year of an internship. I found out yesterday, I did not know this, that they also put you through a psych exam right out of the gate to make sure that you are mentally fit to be, you know, a shepherd of a flock, so to speak. And and there's a series of steps along the way where you meet with an advisor and a panel. And it's almost like, it felt very much like almost like defending your doctoral dissertation. I was like, damn, that's intense. And there are people who get partway through the process who get sent back, like, this is not working, man. You know? And so it feels like they're sort of starting to move towards more of a formal thing. But again, the bullet point in the handbook that talks about one of the criteria to be considered for ministry is being able to show that you have a substantial, or that's not the word they use, but an adequate, I guess, level of biblical and theological understanding. It's like, well, if you have some sort of seminary in place, then successful completion of that, you would think would be the bar, you know, but yet like, who is the arbiter of if you have met that mark or not? And what is that mark? You know?
Yeah. Well, and that never was the case for the Vineyard. Like the Vineyard, like, you know, VLI was, I really loved it. I thought it was really helpful for me, but it wasn't ever a requirement for leaders to go through or pastors to go through. It was more of like a, hey, this is a cool thing. And if you want to get some more training, here you go. But the Vineyard was like a like super, you know, punk rock and grassroots of like, you know, I watch you pastor people, so you're a pastor. And sometimes I think that's great. Like sometimes I think that's awesome. And I remember one of my old pastors who never went through seminary, when people would ask him what seminary he went to, he'd be like, I went to the same seminary as David, and I went to the same seminary. Like he would get like really defensive about it.
Yeah.
But like the idea of like, yeah, it's just the ambiguity of that is really, really hard. And to me, VLI was like the thought behind it was like, hey, we need something like, we need to train our pastors and we need to train our leaders. And the problem that they saw with seminaries was you're taking people out of their context of where they're leading and putting them in this school for 4 years and then putting them back in. So they were thinking like, what if we could create something that you could do like while you were leading and while you were pastoring, or, you know, so you could get trained no matter what. And so they created VLI. And it went through so many different changes over the years. And like, I think it was a good program, but I just think they couldn't figure out how to, because the vineyard pastors, like I said, they're all these cowboys who are like, don't tell me what to do. I'm going to do my own thing. So yeah. So it was like, when they even thought of the idea of making VLI a requirement, it was like, no way, you can't make any requirements for me. So, but I am glad that they're at least thinking about, like, we should have some thoughts about what our vineyard pastor has, how they've been trained and how they've been educated. I just don't like that they are asking us, or I keep on saying us and we, even though I'm not part of the vineyard. They're asking people to get on board with it without giving the details of what.
Well, and it seems like if they came up, and I'm not saying again that that particular model is correct, it is the best or would be the best for vineyard, but some sort of formal established level of coursework that you'd have to go through seems like it would solve a few problems. Number one, if you're really cut out for ministry, you know, to kind of put you through like an internship. But number two, like the other big thing is like, if you're asking people to toe the company line when it comes to certain theological positions, like you got to know what those theological positions are.
Yeah.
To start with. And then on top of that, like one of the things I thought was really cool about it is that it's not just, you know, obviously there's a lot of like coursework that involves like the history of Christianity and, you know, how to read the Bible. And, you know, like they put them through summer Greek, you know, and So they can see like how complicated the original language was and how that causes translation issues and all sorts of things. But beyond that, they also made them take things like, you know, counseling courses, because they're like, you are going to run into situations where you're going to have to minister in that way to people in your congregation, leadership courses, things that like they know, like it's more than just understanding like how to read the Bible and where we came from and where we're going. Like you have to have these other skills too. And so like, it feels like some official version of that would kill several birds with one stone, so to speak.
Yeah, I agree. And even too, going back to one of the things you're saying, like it's always been up to the local church, where like I had to take a psych evaluation to work at a vineyard church, but it wasn't because of the vineyard. It was because of that local church. And I know like, When I was going through the Multiply Vineyard, which was their church planting arm, they did make you go through this thing called a Campion assessment, which is psych evaluation, and then like a like kind of like a strength finder type evaluation. And it was like really, really in depth, and it was really helpful. I loved it. But that was like something that they just like introduced in the last like year or so of doing that. But it's hard that there's never been any formal, like even with the Vineyard being a movement that was like kind of all these churches with all these boomer pastors who were coming to the age where they're about to retire and hand off their church. There's no formal, like even conversation about like, hey, what are some good ways to do that? Like, how do we, and I know when my dad retired, they did a really successful handoff where there wasn't it was a pretty successful handoff. And I remember them reaching out to Vineyard USA and saying like, hey, would you like us to do like put together some kind of workshop for this or something? And it was like kind of met with silence. Like, so like, it just feels like there's all of these things that would require, not even require, but just would be so helpful. Like, it just seems like it would be so helpful and really good for the movement if some of these things were in place. And you haven't done that, and now that you're trying to do it, you're doing it in a way that's like kind of dipping a toe in and not like really saying, this is what we're doing. And I think one of the reasons is I think the Vineyard has this identity crisis of, you have pastors in the Vineyard who are essentially white Christian nationalists, and then you have Vineyard pastors who are like relatively progressive. And that's interesting, because growing up in Central Ohio, the Vineyards were always like kind of on the cutting edge of like immigration issues and women in leadership issues and racial reconciliation issues, not so much with LGBTQ issues. But my experience with the Vineyard has always been like, oh, we're very justice oriented. But then you see other pastors who are like, you know, this woke agenda, and, you know, like Trump is the savior of, I think it's this identity issue of like, well, we want to have this centralized idea of what the vineyard is, but I don't even think the vineyard knows what it is. Does that make sense?
No, that totally kind of confirms the vibe or the essence that I was getting, is that you've got sort of this struggle between the old guard and the new, and, you know, folks who are hanging on, who pined for the glory days under John Wimber, and yet also kind of want to be, continue to be the hip, cool thing. And then you've got sort of this difference of opinion. I mean, even looking at Duluth, just in the way, the difference of approach between the local church and the national entity, it just feels like there's this weird tension that exists in terms of how to even move forward. And like, who are we? What do we want to be? Like, it doesn't seem very clear.
Yeah. And I think what, just on a personal level, what's really difficult is reconciling that idea of this place that formed me and really made me who I am today and invested in me. I look at it and I think it feels like, even though I was the one who officially left, it feels like I had been abandoned, and like I had been told my whole life that I was family and that I was cared for and I was loved. And then the moment where I disagreed with one issue, I was basically said, you can't be part of the family anymore. And it's heartbreaking. Like, it's heartbreaking to feel like, on the other side, I've, like, you know, over the years, I've listened to podcasts and watched specials about these church movements that have had all of this brokenness and all of this abuse and all of these horrible things. And I'd always think, I'm so glad that I'm part of the vineyard. We're different. And what has been really heartbreaking is realizing, I don't think we are different. And it doesn't mean we're worse, or we're, doesn't mean the vineyard is evil. It just means, like, I put the vineyard on this pedestal that we could be something that we aren't. I think that it's really hard. It's really hard. And I think it goes back to this idea of, I don't know. And I don't know how this podcast is going to end up, you know, how the vineyard is going to be painted. But I really deeply grieve for it. And I deeply, deeply love the vineyard and love what it has done for me. And I don't think the problem is the vineyard. I think the problem is that, I think where American Christianity, not even American, where human beings have taken the church feels so far removed from the thing that Jesus said, this is my church that I'm establishing, that the gates of hell even prevail. Yeah, just little things, like even like when I left the vineyard and I remember watching little things about the national conference, and it was the first national conference that I had not gone to in decades. Not one person texted me or emailed me to say, hey, buddy, where are you? Or like, we miss you. Or like, are you doing okay? And the only people who did do that were people outside of the vineyard who were like, I remember, I don't know if you talked to Mallory, but there's this gal named Mallory who pastors a church in Tennessee that used to be a vineyard. And I remember her texting me like, this week is probably kind of hard for you. Are you doing okay? And I was like, man, thank you for texting me. That's so cool. And what made it even harder was, again, my buddy Evan. We had lunch afterwards, and I remember talking to Evan and saying that, like, no one reached out. And he's like, oh, buddy, so many people were asking me about you and asking how you're doing. And I was like, that makes me feel worse. Like, that they want to talk about me, but, you know, but no one reached out. And I remember being on the other side of that, about, you know, talking about the apostate church and like the church that, like, you know, and yeah, it's just hard, because as much as we've talked about family, as much as we've talked about the thing that the vineyard was, this dialed down, like, we sing simple love songs to Jesus and this simple devotion to Christ and this thing where we are we're trying to do things differently than what we've seen. And then to see, like, we're doing the same thing again. We're just part of that. And it doesn't, you know, sometimes I'll get in this thing where I get really angry at the vineyard and really, like, you know, I get full of like lots of judgment and bitterness. And I think when I look at the vineyard, I think of, there are hundreds, if not thousands, of pastors who are doing their best and really trying to serve the Lord and really love people. And I just don't know if I think the system that is in place in America for what churches are is broken from the beginning. And so I think you know, no matter what system you put in place, it's broken. And I think we need, I really believe what needs to happen is like a new reformation, like something where we say, let's throw all the old models away. And you can still preach sermons and you can still play your acoustic guitar and all that stuff. But like, what if we thought about church in a different way? And instead of thinking about it like the 50s and 70s and 90s model of what church growth looks like, what if we took the New Testament and we took the model of the Sermon on the Mount and said, what if it looked like this? And like, that's what I'm trying to do up here in Cleveland, and it is messy, and I don't know if we're doing it right. And we're like, you know, our systems that we have in place, we're still working out, and we're like still trying to figure out what accountability looks like when you're not part of a bigger thing. But I just don't know how many reorgs or new booklets are going to fix the problem of what power and centralized leadership does to the.
Looking to buy your dream home? Or rent that perfect apartment? With the Redfin app, you'll know the moment your next place hits the market. Set up your gotta-have-it wish list, and Redfin will send you real-time notifications for properties that match. And when you're ready to see it in person, scheduling a tour is just a tap away. Thinking about selling? Redfin can do that too. In fact, Redfin agents close twice as many deals as other agents, so they know how to get the best price for your home. And with a listing fee as low as 1%, Redfin charges half of what others often charge. So you could save big, like really big. Last year, Redfin saved home sellers $118 million. So whether you're buying, renting, or selling, Redfin's ready to help you win. Download the Redfin app and start searching today.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I don't want to lose sight of your personal story either. So I definitely wanted to make sure that you had the opportunity to kind of talk about the central issue that ultimately ended with you kind of leaving the Vineyard and becoming an affirming church and meeting the needs of your congregation. And one of the things I wanted to comment on is the fact that every single person I've talked to who has a similar story to yours, where they approached the Vineyard and thought that the issue would be handled in much the same way that they've handled previous issues. So if you look at the history of the Vineyard in terms of making sort of theological changes, you know, an easy one to look at is how they handled women in leadership. And it was very much because the local church is autonomous, like we're not going to force this on you, but we are open to it at this point. And if you want to do it, great. You have our blessing. If you don't, that's fine too. And so you saw this kind of like slow migration over time. And so every single person I've talked to, I almost started laughing by the end because you all said the same thing. You're like, you went to the Vineyard and like, we think we can be the test model for this. It got to the point where I'm like, you literally all thought the same thing, but because they're so quiet about it, no one knew. Like Ken Wilson was, you know, kind of arguably the first one to do it, wrote a position paper and literally used those exact same words. But because no one really knows his actual story, you know, you've got like in Tom Wozniak and Melody Winterweedle and all these other folks who came after who, you know, thought the same thing. And then, you know, so talk about like, you know, your thinking, obviously you thought, hey, this is something that could possibly happen. And so you went in kind of feeling positive about this and wanted just to have some open conversations about it. And then what happened?
Yeah. Well, hey, first, I was calling Melody Mallory earlier in my story. So
I thought that's who you meant, but you know, that's, yeah, she's great.
Yeah. We'll edit that out. I said, I'll give you a clean Melody. yeah. Like, so I don't know. I don't think I expected the Vineyard to be okay with it. I don't think that I kind of knew the writing was on the wall, but there was this little part inside of me that I don't know if it was, you know, me being naive or me being arrogant, but there's something about like, I think maybe the way I communicate this might actually change someone's mind. And maybe like, because I mean, I had so many conversations with pastors where I would say like, why we want to do this and why we want to be affirming. Even like, yeah, that they were like, I really love your heart in this. And I don't know if I agree with you theologically, but I think it's cool what you're trying to do. So I thought like, hey, maybe if I talk to these people and say what we're doing, I don't think they're going to let us do it. But I think there's like that hope beyond hope that maybe I can change someone's mind. Because really what it was for us is it was a theological question that I've had forever. You know, growing up being, you know, an elder millennial and growing up in like artsy scenes and working at coffee shops and all this, like so many of my friends were queer. And there was always this thing that was like, gosh, I don't know if I agree with the church's stance on this, but like people who are way smarter than me have told me this is what I have to believe. And this is the only way to interpret this. And it took me like, you know, I ended up reading God and the Gay Christian by Matthew Vines. And that book, like, even though I wasn't like, I would say I was like fully convinced by it, it was definitely like, this is at least presenting it in a way that good Jesus-loving Christians can disagree about. And so that's the way I approached it with like the area leaders and stuff, was saying, my thing is not that anyone has to change their mind. The Vineyard doesn't have to change their stance, but can't we at least say that good Christian can disagree about this? And, you know, we've been a big tent movement with everything else. Like everything else we've said, we're going to let the local church decide how they're going to walk this issue out. But can't we do that with this issue too? And it was just, you know, met with a resounding no. And I remember talking to my regional leader and they were saying, listen, you know, as long as you don't perform a wedding or ordain someone who is like in a, you know, who is LGBTQ, you're good. You can have those beliefs even, but you, like those are the foul lines. You can't do that. And I just knew like I'm not cool with that. Like I don't want to do that. Like I know that there's queer couples in my church that are eventually going to ask me to do their wedding, and I'm going to do it. And I don't want to wait to be kicked out. Like I don't want to wait to like cause a stink. Like I, you know, so that's where it kind of was, where I was just like, listen, I don't want to get kicked out. I think that would hurt more. I want to like, you know, I want to leave with it feeling like, hey, let's just agree to be friends. And, you know, you can still come around and hang out. And then like, it was just very clear that like, no, we're not friends anymore. You know, like, and no one said that to me. Well, some people said some very nasty things to me, but it was just that thing of like, I am not family anymore. And we're, you know, it's like an ex-girlfriend or something that you say, like, we're going to keep in touch. And then you realize, no, we're not. Like, and so that was even hard too. Of like, I had to like, you know, I wanted to like still be kind of like, they used to call it a friend of the Vineyard. Like you weren't a part of the Vineyard, but you were a friend of the Vineyard. But I had to like, stop following certain pages and stuff, because it was like, you know, when you go on that deep dive of your ex and you're like, this is not healthy, I shouldn't do this. So yeah, so and it was like, yeah, so that situation was like, no one forcefully told me to leave, but it was essentially like, if you do these things, you will be kicked out. And there's, I mean, Jay Pathak said, I will never lead a movement that is affirming or make space for affirming theology, point blank in a Zoom call. And yeah, and some, all the other area leaders and regional leaders just, and even I'll say this, I talked to many pastors in the Vineyard who are still Vineyard pastors and some of very prominent churches who have said, hey, I agree with you, but I can't say anything. So it's just this confusing, difficult thing where I think more and more pastors are feeling this tension of like the fruit of the old model of how we, you know, love the sinner, hate the sin is bad. And like the suicide rates, everything, it's all bad. It's all bad. We need to have a new way. And you even see Andy Stanley like doing things where you're like, wow, like, that's kind of cool that he's moving forward. And you have so many Vineyard pastors who are at least there, who maybe have changed their theology, but are at least changing their practices. And then you have a handful who are doubling down. And I mean, it's the same thing in politics. You have, you know, people who are doubling down on white nationalism and, you know, we're going to end DEI and do all this stuff. And I think it's the same thing that's happening, is like, it feels like there was this momentum. And I've talked to all these pastors who are, and I sincerely do believe that at some point if the vineyard is around forever or for the next 20 years, at some point, I think they're going to make space for affirming churches. I just think it's going to happen. But it is in this thing now where I think there's so much fear. There's so much fear within lots of pastors. Like if we allow affirming churches to be part of the vineyard, what partnerships do we lose? And what people leave? And what people with money do we lose? Because I've talked to pastors who are like, we want to be an affirming church, but our number one giver is not affirming. And if we lose them, we can't be a church anymore. So it's complicated. And I think there's probably even people on the national level who are wrestling with that too, who maybe would say, you know, secretly, I agree with JT, but I can't say anything.
Well, and what's interesting about you saying that is, you know, it is pretty much a fact that, you know, if you look at some of the other denominations and movements who have boldly faced that question and posed it to their church body, that you will lose churches. Like, there is no doubt about it. With a movement that size, you will lose churches. I mean, ELC Lutherans put it to a vote nationally. The Methodists put it to a vote nationally. And there was, you know, there were churches that happily were like, finally. And then there were churches who were like, heck no, we're not doing it. And they pulled out and formed their own sort of variation of Lutheran and Methodist or whatever. So, you know, I think, you know, there probably is some trepidation and some fear there where they see examples of this playing out in the public forum and they're like, yeah, we could lose a lot of money and a lot of churches that could cut our movement down. But at some point, sort of like, you know, dealing with the aftermath of abuse, doing the right thing isn't always necessarily the cleanest thing.
Absolutely. Well, and I think my number one value in life, and like, I think I get it from both of my parents, was like this idea of integrity trumps like everything, and doing what's right, even when it's hard, or even when everyone, like, here's something that really bothered. In a conversation with one of the leaders, I was told, and this is actually not uncommon, a lot of people said something like this to me, but I was told, like, don't take the easy way out. Like, I know it feels easier to, you know, say, we're going to be affirming. I was like, are you kidding me? Like, this is the hardest thing that I have done. Like, it would be so much easier for me to just be a part of the bigger thing and like stay part of the vineyard and like just say, this is what we're doing. It's so much harder for me to take a stand about something that I believe in and lose friendship and lose financial backing and lose these things. And so for me, it was like, becoming an affirming church for us was far easier than most churches. Like, I would say almost everyone in our church was affirming. Like, when we officially became an affirming church, they were like, cool. Like, finally. Like, but it was, I think what was hard for me was just the other things, like losing the relationship. And yeah, doing what's right is sometimes really hard, but like, gosh, isn't that the model that we saw, like, with Jesus and with Paul and with all the, you know, the disciples? And yeah, that's it's just a shame that like so much fear is attached to a lot of these questions. Like, even the abuse thing. Well, if we admit that we mishandled this, like, what happens to us financially? Do we get sued? Do we, like, you know, do we, you know, whatever it is, or like, if we admit that this happened, is there going to be some podcast that paints us in a bad light, or, you know, whatever it is? And I get that. Cause here's the other thing, is my natural inclination, like, if there's something happening in the church that I pastor that's not good, or there's a bad, my natural inclination is, you know, I'm going to take the power and stop it. And like, I'm going to become a stronger, more dominant leader. I'm an 8 on the Enneagram. So I think a lot of times that's what my natural inclination is to do stuff like that. But I have learned over the years that I fight against that. Like, cause when you do that, like, nothing grows. And not only do the bad weeds not grow, but the fruits and, you know, beautiful flowers don't grow either. So like, I think in one sense, I feel like that's what the vineyard's response is now. They see Duluth. They see Anaheim. They see a number of these other things happening. And their thing is like, let's circle the wagon and be strong. And really, I feel like the model is like, what if we were humble and weak and really trusted the Lord to say, if you, you know, like, I look at people who, you know, even hearing the Gatlins not participating with the investigation and knowing that they were told not to by people, like, it's like, gosh, like, maybe that's the human wisdom would say that, but like, aren't we taught like that, like, the way of the kingdom is foolishness to the world? Like, when it just feels like the vineyard is now, it feels like it's moving towards power, where I was, what attracted me to the vineyard was this thing of distributing power and saying everybody gets to play and there are no celebrities. And so, like, kind of circling back, like, for me, the idea of us becoming affirming and knowing that we were going to get kicked out, but having this hope beyond hope that maybe we could stay was just an example of that. Like, I feel like if you were to come to my church, when people come into my church, one of the things that I hear from vineyard people is, oh, this feels like the old vineyard. Like, it feels like really like laid back and everyone's just like worshiping and loving Jesus and it's real comfortable. And there's like, you know, this distribution of who gets to, you know, be behind the pulpit and people are praying for each other. But just because we say that queer people can get married and love each other, we're told we don't get to play. So. Yeah.
Yeah, it is disappointing, a lot of the things that I've learned throughout kind of looking into all of these. I think that the most disappointing thing almost really at this point for me isn't what allowed the structural failings that sort of allowed for the horrible things to take place. The disappointing thing for me is in the aftermath, the response, in some cases, the lack of response or the type of response, like just hearing, like, for example, you know, like, I know you're being very good, by the way. I'm very impressed how you've not really called anyone out by name. So that's good.
Don't let me do it, John. I don't want to do it. I really want to not.
I don't mind. I'll do it. Like, no, I'm not intentionally trying to call anybody out, but like, I think there are some folks who like need to answer some questions and. Yeah. And kind of like need to answer. I think the public, especially the victims, need to understand why, like, certain decisions. And so, like, one in particular, you know, I mentioned, you know, Rob's position on the Gatlins and their involvement in the aftermath. And like, even like Rich Nathan from hometown here calling Duluth and trying to talk them out of hiring Grace and all the reasons he listed reasons why they shouldn't hire Grace. You know, I'm talking to the interim pastor there and he's like, those are all the reasons why we should hire Grace. Like, it all came down to the ability to control the ultimate, you know, the narrative or the outcome of the investigation and the scope and all that stuff. And they're like, if we're really trying to weed out the things that caused us to be where we are right now, which is just an absolute mess. Like, it should be a no holds barred investigation. They should have access to everything. And we should put all our cards out on the table and see where we stand. And like, yeah. And take a deep look at, like, all right, there's some things we need to fix, obviously. And so let's truthfully and put our heart out there on the table as well and say, like, we screwed up. We did. We absolutely did. So like, but how do we move forward in a way that regains that trust? In that process, a while, like, credibility takes seconds to lose and it takes ages to regain. And again, one of those things I learned in leadership courses, but like, you know, the approach that isn't that feels like it's just damage control and playing the PR game.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, I feel like what's unfortunate is, you know, I don't have a ton of experience with Grace. I know we've worked with them a little bit with our church, like, to try to do some preliminary things. Like, how do we put systems in place so we don't have to call you in the future? Like, you know, so, but a lot of the stuff that I've even talked to pastors who have worked with Grace and they've said things like, yeah, like, we're really frustrated with them because they won't let us change some of this wording. And I'm like, gosh, like, what's the point of having a third party like investigation if you still want to control the narrative? Like, you know,
yeah, why do you want to change the wording? Like, what makes you want to change the wording? Like, is it because you look bad in this? Well, you're gonna look bad.
Yeah. Like, if you've done something wrong, like, just own it. Own it. But yeah, I think a lot of the things too. Or one of the things is, I'm just trying to decide.
No, I totally understand. You have to be very careful. And now you're responding to this. Like, And this is, I think this is what I'm trying to convey in the course of the podcast also, is like, this is not like a very black and white. And I don't think, by the way, I don't think any of the other podcasts that predate this one that talk about the rise and fall of Mars Hill or Hillsong, I don't think any of those situations were probably like as black and white as maybe some of the series made them seem. Because when you're talking about movements that large, I think what the story often misses out on is the human aspect of it and all of the predominantly good people who are caught in the crossfire of when scandals like that occur, you know, and you know, the vast majority of the people I've met through Vineyard are awesome people, are great people. Mm-hmm. Some of my best friends I met, you know, through the Vineyard, you know, and so like those people sort of get left out of the story. And so when we do talk about really crappy situations like this, it becomes very complicated because inevitably it touches on someone that you know and respect and have a ship with. And you're like, you know, how do we even talk about this? It becomes really complicated.
Well, and I know, I mean, there have been people who I've deeply respected who skeletons have come out that have like ruined my perception of them. And so I know for a fact, like, I think there are people, not think, I know that there are people who are the main players in this Vineyard narrative who are bad players and who are have bad intention. But I also agree with you. There are people who are in tough situations where they don't know how to handle things, and maybe they've handled things incorrectly, and maybe they don't see it right now, but maybe they'll see it in a few years or 5 years or something. And then there's people who are like getting lumped in with those people who are like, I'm just trying my best. And I'm just like, you know, I know as a pastor, there have been things where like people have come to me and said, you did this. And there have been times where I've been like, you are absolutely right. And I deeply apologize. And then there have been things where you're like, what are you talking about? Like, that is so far off base. And so I know that every narrative that you hear, there's always two sides and all those things. But I also think the tendency that I'm seeing right now in these larger movements, and you see it in the Vineyard, is that idea of how do we protect our narrative? And so, you know, with those things like grace and with those things like these pastors who are like trying to figure out how do we keep our church afloat and how do we keep the Vineyard as a movement afloat, and you know, how do I keep my job and all those things? It's complicated. But gosh, I think that there is no excuse for dishonesty. There's no excuse for just, it feels like if you do not centralize victims in these things and like honor them and do what is just human decency of like I know some victims where if they would have just received a phone call from someone to be like, hey, just want to say we love you and we are here for you, that would have been enough.
Yes.
And some of the issues aren't even like what happened, it is how the situations were handled. It was like what's been hurtful for people is not that something bad happened. It was that something bad happened and the Vineyard's response was cruel. And whether the intention was to be cruel, it was cruel. And I think a lot of the reasons are like legal reasons. And that's why like the Vineyard, like, you know, I don't want to speculate, but like Vineyard hiring firm that are also, you know, they're also working with very well-known bad people. And like the Vineyard is having people sign NDAs and like all those things where I'm like, this is not the kingdom. Like, how did we get here? And even if it's legally, if it makes sense, and even if it makes sense on a, you know, if a company would do it, it doesn't make sense for people of Jesus to do it. So like, yeah, that's my problem is like, if I was working for like, you know, some tech company and I was asking people to sign NDAs and stuff, that might make sense. But when I'm working, when I am hired as someone who's supposed to shepherd people, and my number one, my dad would always say this to me, like, your job as a pastor is to care for people and to put your arm around them and point to Jesus and say, isn't he beautiful? And if that's my job, then all this other stuff feels like it is like, you have to ask the question, how did we get here? And what can we do to go back to what it was? So yeah.
Yeah. And I realize we've definitely gone well over time. So I really appreciate your time, JT.
Yeah.
So what any final thoughts, anything that you think is important for people to hear in all?
I think if there's anything, it's that, like, I don't think the vineyard is bad. I think, like we said, the vineyard is a place where broken people are, for the most part, trying their best to serve Jesus and to like expand his kingdom. Like we talked about John Wimber doing the stuff, like they're trying to do the stuff and the system. No, let me say this. They're trying to do the stuff. And what happens when broken people are involved in systems is those systems become broken as well. And so I think the vineyard is trying their best in a lot of ways and missing the mark because we're broken people. And then I also want to affirm that there are people who have been deeply hurt by the vineyard and they deserve better. And they deserve to have people take responsibility and have justice and accountability and to be treated as the image bearers of God that they are. But I want to leave with this thought is that it has been really, I've been in so many spaces recently of these like post-evangelical places, and there's been a lot of healing in those places. But another thing that I've seen is this thread of bitterness in those spaces and a thread of pointing the finger and saying, we are better and we are not like that. And cynicism and bitterness, those aren't fruits of the Spirit either. And so I am trying right now to, when I think about the vineyard, is to pray for the vineyard and to bless the vineyard and to not, like, when I feel that bitterness of like, they did this to me. And I can look at, I could go through other specific examples of ways that I had been hurt by leaders in the vineyard, but I'm trying really hard to say, I forgive them. And Lord, would you bless them? And Lord, can we be a movement? Whatever I'm doing now, like whatever church I'm pastoring, can we be a church that doesn't ignore the problems and doesn't ignore issues, but keeps our eyes focused on Jesus as well? Because I don't want to be a look back movement or a look back church on either side of like, and I noticed that for like a few months after leaving the vineyard, so many of my sermons and so many of my conversations were not, I maybe didn't say the vineyard, but there was like this spirit of cynicism and negativity where I'd be like, we're not like these people, we're this. But one of the things that I'm really trying to do is keep my eye on Jesus and also be the type of Christian who says, how am I culpable in these things? Like, what am I doing that is marginalizing people? And what am I doing that is causing these systems of abuse? And what have I done that I need to repent of? And instead of patting myself on the back that I'm not doing that thing anymore, like, what if I continued that and like tried to create a place where people can heal? So yeah, I just leave with that idea.
I love that. And I so appreciate your time, JT. And I know, not lost on me, how a difficult situation, you know, decision rather was made even more difficult by the fact that, you know, your family is so deeply rooted in the vineyard movement. And so yours is an unusual story in the sense that an already difficult position to be in, you know, was made even more difficult. You know, I have no doubt.
Yeah, I went back and forth. Like at first I was like, yeah, I'll do it. And then I was like, I don't want to do it. But you know, I hope I was able to come across not super bitter or negative. And I hope it comes across that I love the vineyard. And even though I've been hurt in certain ways, I'm rooting for it.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, and I appreciate that too, because that is you know, a lot of what I'm trying to convey through this podcast. And hopefully, I don't know how successful I'll be. I don't even know if this podcast will be good, JT. It could be terrible. And maybe no one will listen to it. Who knows? But, you know, my hope is that it does come forward. And it was important to me to also record, you know, that first question. You know, I asked everyone the same question. I'm like, what was it about Vineyard that really like hooked you and kind of pulled you in? Because there was some reason why you joined that movement amongst all the other 48,000 denominations or variations of Christianity. You picked the vineyard for a reason. And
yeah,
at least at one point, like, you can say, hey, that was where I needed to be. And we say similar things on the Deconstructionist podcast, just about, you know, to the point you're making earlier, saying like, look, some people have every reason in the world to come out of a situation like that and be pissed off and be angry.
Yeah, for sure.
And like, there's a place for that. But like what I try to encourage people to do is like, but it's not a healthy place to stay.
Absolutely.
And at some point, anger, let it go, you know?
Yeah. Anger is a God-given emotion. And we see that Jesus was angry. We like being angry is not a problem, but it's what we do in that anger. And it's if you choose to live in that anger. I mean, when the Bible talks about how dangerous anger is, it's not that anger in itself is a bad thing. It's that anger leads to things like violence and bitterness and these things that aren't good. So when I'm angry, typically I try to say, okay, like I'm probably angry for a reason and I want to honor that. But I need to really, really also look to Jesus and say, what do I do with this anger? So I'm trying to do that.
Looking to buy your dream home or rent that perfect apartment? With the Redfin app, you'll know the moment your next place hits the market. Set up your gotta-have-it wish list, and Redfin will send you real-time notifications for properties that match. And when you're ready to see it in person, scheduling a tour is just a tap away. Thinking about selling? Redfin can do that too. In fact, Redfin agents close twice as many deals as other agents, so they know how to get the best price for your home. And with a listing fee as low as 1%, Redfin charges half of what others often charge. So you could save big, like really big. Last year, Redfin saved home sellers $118 million. So whether you're buying, renting, or selling, Redfin's ready to help you win. Download the Redfin app and start searching today.